From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1969 at the Wall Street Journal. An intern named Joanne Lublin was concluding, I should say, a very successful stint there. She wrote 5 major feature stories that summer alone. Lublin had earned respect from editors and staff, but it was what happened next that was so surprising. In fact, Lublin suppressed the memory of what happened next for many years. She's going to explain coming up, but that did not stop her from building a powerhouse career at the Wall Street Journal. In 1992, she became deputy management editor, and in 1993, she created the journal's Managing Your Career column. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her work exposing corporate scandals. Her current advice column is called Your Executive Career, and now she has a book out examining how women can succeed in the corporate world, learning from not only her own experiences, good and bad, and the experiences of successful female executives, more than 50 of them. Tonight, Joanne Lublin is talking about her book and her work at 7 p.m. It's a free public lecture in the Hawkins Carlson Room of the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. But first, she's here talking about the book, which came out in October. It's called Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. My guest on Connections is Joanne Lublin. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there are already a wide range of books and literature on the subject, this kind of subject in the marketplace. How did you decide to approach the subject that would add something new, especially for women kind of making their way in the world?
Well, it mostly grew out of the fact I've been writing about management and workplace issues for over a quarter of a century for the Wall Street Journal. And I figured that there were probably a lot of women out there who had battled gender bias early in their careers, like I had, that perhaps had made them better leaders. So that was kind of the idea of the book. What was it that they had done to overcome obstacles that did make them better leaders, particularly as related to their gender?
And, you know, you might have heard Joanne many times over the years on NPR, All Things Considered, talking about her book in various venues. I know NPR, at one point, for example, wanted you to tell the story of what happened at the end of your internship in 1969. And I'd ask you to share it as well, because I think the story is compelling, but I also wonder if you think what happened in 1969 is still as prevalent or very prevalent today.
Well, what happened to me on my last day as a summer intern in the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau was the man who had been my direct supervisor walked me out of the office, and it was a long corridor that led to the outside door to leave the office. And to say goodbye, he, rather than shake my hand, he leaned down and kissed me on the lips. And I was absolutely flabbergasted to the point that I did nothing, said nothing. All I could think of was, I can't tell anybody. This would absolutely kill my chances of having a journalism career. And then I never thought about it again until years later when I was covering the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings.
You suppressed the memory. You really did.
I really did. And at that point, I had already done some writing about sexual harassment and what employers were trying to do to combat it. Unfortunately, as I've gone around the country talking about the book, I've heard echoes of this kind of situation. In some cases, it's from mothers of 20-something daughters who are saying, I had to put up with this kind of stuff when I entered the workforce, and now my daughter has just entered the workforce, and she's still getting sexually harassed, maybe not, you know, getting kissed on the lips, but certainly getting invited or propositioned or asked to do things that make them uncomfortable because of their gender. And I'm often asked, you know, when does this go away?
I imagine women have thanked you for sharing, being willing to share that story.
Well, and then I've heard many similar stories. There have been a couple events in which the organizers have asked my predominantly female audience, and these are often women ranging in ages from, again, early 20s to mid-50s, what percentage of you have ever been sexually harassed in the workplace? And it's usually anywhere from 60-80% of the women raise their hands. And the first time that happened, I was just blown away. And I then ran into a woman in the ladies' room who turned out to be a consultant on these issues, and she wasn't surprised at all.
Talking to Joanne Lublin, and listeners, I want to appeal to you. We're going to be talking about the pay gap, how to cut it down, ideas, particularly for women making their way in the business world, the corporate world. But if you've got questions or comments, if you want to share your experience as well, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I know I previewed her appearance earlier this morning. I've got a few of your emails that we can get to a little bit later in the program. You can email me as well, edawson@wxxi.org. Now, you spoke to dozens of female executives, as you said. Many of them went through their own hard times in their own lives in various ways, sometimes going through abuse, rising through and rising kind of above a lot of tall challenges.
Both personal and professional.
Yeah, and you got a lot of people to open up to you. I imagine you had developed a lot of relationships over the years at the Journal with them, yes?
Some of these women I had known for a long time. One woman who I interviewed for the book was somebody who I had profiled over 30 years ago when she was the only African-American female branch manager at a big bank in Chicago. And she was in her 20s at that point, and she went through a lot of hard times.
Now, I want to talk about the pay gap because, just interestingly enough, I was just reading Christina Summers, who writes for the American Enterprise Institute. She calls herself the factual feminist, and she likes to dispute that there's much of a real pay gap. She cautions journalists to say that there's two different kinds of pay gap. Number one, men make more than women. We're talking gross earnings, but we're not talking same jobs. We're talking overall in this country, men make more. That's where the 77 cents roughly on the dollar comes in. But when you look at same pay for the same work, it's in the low 90s. From what I've seen various studies, Joanne, it's 91, 92 cents. I don't find that acceptable at all, that there is a difference to begin with. But do you agree that we should be specific when we talk about what the pay gap is?
Well, I think, you know, depending on how sharp your knife is and what the shape of the pie is, you can cut anything any way you want. And often it's done to sort of satisfy somebody's inherent prejudice or point of view to begin with. So I've seen a lot of those statistics. I've seen statistics suggesting the pay gap is actually wider than widely reported.
Okay.
But I think most of the well-respected studies, when they control for things like whether it's full-time work, educational level, you know, those kinds of things, it's still a significant gap, however you count it. And what's even more distressing is that it's still there more than half a century after women in significant numbers entered the workforce.
You point out in your book that the CEO, I'm trying to remember, I don't have this, I think of Reddit, decided, you know, essentially no negotiating coming in. Men, women, you're going to get the same. This job is this salary, because historically in this country, men negotiate harder, especially coming in the door. Do you support that kind of approach?
Well, I think it's one of the realizations that has grown out of a number of tech companies doing these pay equity studies, in which they find out that indeed there are gaps that seem to be gender related, but just fixing them at the moment doesn't get to the underlying cause, which is that the woman is coming in at a disadvantage, either because she's not as assertive in negotiating or because she was underpaid at the prior job. So to the extent that you price a job irrespective of the pay that applicant had before, I think that probably could help, but it's going to vary by the workplace.
Yeah, at one point you write that, you know, not blaming women entirely, but you say women themselves have a role in what the gap currently is. And you're kind of touching on that now, but can
right.
you expand on that?
Well, the overarching theme to that chapter in the book is, you know, if you don't ask, you don't get. And as I said in that chapter, you've got to come in prepared to negotiate. You can't just come in and say, I deserve more. And so after I wrote the book, I realized that I really had never followed my own advice. Every step of the way, anytime I got a transfer or when I got promoted into management, I never pushed back. I never challenged.
You took the first offer?
Absolutely. And so I decided, well, now that I've written this book, I've got to eat my own pudding. And so after the book came out, Money Magazine asked me to do a freelance piece for them based on this chapter. And I said to my publisher, well, given that if I don't ask, I don't get, I'm going to ask for a freelance fee. And I got pushback. The publisher said, no, 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 you don't understand. That's not how it works. This is, you know, free publicity for the book. And I said, no, you don't understand. I got to be faithful to what I'm preaching in this book. So I did ask, and I was told, no, there are no freelance fees. And, you know, you can either do it for nothing or not do it at all. So I did it for nothing.
But
But at least I asked, okay?
Sure, sure. And you know, on page 98, for example, you write that women should find out, and I'm trying to, let me quote from the book here, find out how much people at the same job level earn inside and outside the company, even if your role isn't identical, so you can decide whether to make a fuss. And then you add that it's crucial that women do this, but you don't really explain how to do it. And isn't it really tough for some people, women especially, to find out what other people are making? Yeah, I don't disagree that they can do it. They should, but how?
Right. I'd say it's the biggest taboo in our society. I think people are more reluctant to ask somebody else how much they make than whether they had sex that week. And so I think the way you do this is you use your network. And pretty much people, you know, if you're well connected, are going to have some idea as to who's making what in a comparable position. And if you don't have those people in your network, then you need to have a different or a bigger network. And that may involve, for instance, getting to know recruiters who recruit in your profession or in your industry. They're going to know what people make.
It's tough, though, isn't it? I mean, I can't sit here and tell you that I know what talk show hosts make in other markets. Maybe some, and I'd like to know more. If any talk show hosts are listening right now, you can email me, edawson@wxxi.org. No, it's really valuable information. I just think, you know, I think it's important to address that. Can be really hard to get. And then I'm looking at, you know, the executives you talk to. They have inspiring stories, and a lot of them ended up with multi-million dollar packages. Some of them came from very tough financial circumstances.
A lot of these women who ultimately become public company chief executives came from working class backgrounds. Some of them were the first members of their family to ever go to college. These were women in one case where her ultimate lifelong dream was to make $30,000 a year because she thought then she could never have to rely on another person, namely a man, to financially support her. She's the highest woman executive at Intel and obviously the highest paid woman at Intel, Diane Bryant.
Do you find that some of these stories, these women were fueled by this notion of, I grew up like this, we're not going to live like this, I'm not going to raise my family like this. Did you find that drive behind many of these stories?
I did not get the sense, with the exception of Diane, that any of these women were driven by the desire to be rich or affluent. In her case, you know, her financial ambitions were rather modest as we look back, but she was escaping from a pretty horrible home life. And I think what drove a lot of these women was the need to prove that they could be as good as they really thought they were or who their parents told them they thought they could do.
Now, they're doing just fine for themselves now. That's why you talk to them, no doubt about it. But I think a lot of the pay gap probably comes from women and people. But if we're going to talk men and women, women who are not going to make multi-million dollar packages.
Of course not.
You know, but the woman who makes 40 but wants to make 50, or a woman who makes 55 but feels like, I'm pretty sure the guys make 65, or maybe you make 60 but you really think you deserve 80. And is this book going to help them close that gap?
Well, it all depends on their particular situation. And more importantly, it depends on whether where they work, if there are higher ranking women who have gone through what they're about to do or trying to do, and perhaps have figured out better techniques, better strategies than the ones I came up with by interviewing these women. And I think that women do not reach out enough for help, whether it's from a wise, more senior woman in their workplace or a trusted male confidant who's been down that road. You'd be amazed at how much knowledge people we work with have if you ask in the right way that they're willing to share. They may not be able to want to tell you to the nickel how much money they make, but you've seen how they've risen in their position in their place in that company, and you want some advice.
The book is big on mentoring, and it's building that kind of relationship.
And sponsors.
And when people, define the difference between a mentor and a sponsor.
Sure. So a mentor is somebody who you're going to turn to for informal guidance, informal advice, and who you can rely on to sort of tell you when you're making a fool of yourself privately, of course. A sponsor is someone who's willing to invest their professional reputation on your behalf, either because they see you as a rising star or because, more importantly, you've brought something to the relationship with that sponsor that they appreciate. Either you know about an emerging technology or an industry, or you've helped them to become successful. And so it's got to be a two-way relationship, but it also has to be something whereby sponsoring you, that sponsor looks good. Oh my God, you got Evan hired for All Things Considered. Wow, you must be really super.
Well, and this book, Earning It, is aimed at women, but is this advice for both women and men, or is
Absolutely.
This particular
no.
for women?
And frankly, as I got into reporting the book, it became real clear that a lot of these women, while they had dealt with issues in their careers that related to their gender, they also had dealt with issues in terms of career setbacks that apply to men and women alike. They didn't get the job they really wanted when they first got out of college. They got turned down for the first promotion or for the promotion that they really wanted. They got fired at some point in their career, and it came out of left field. They really weren't expecting it. And how they dealt with these obstacles, as well as personal setbacks, tragedies, illnesses, deaths of spouses, is, to me, an underlying theme to the book and what made a lot of these women better leaders and make men better leaders as well.
How do you ask someone to be a sponsor? How do you ask someone to be a mentor?
Well, you don't ask in any of these cases. You, first of all, find ways to bring something to the party to develop a professional working relationship, whether it's a mentor or a sponsor. There are a number of companies, and I mentioned some in the book, American Express among them, that have set up formal sponsorship programs for women. But I think at the end of the day, while the formal programs are helpful, you've got to have informal relationships, informal mentorships and sponsorships. And you're going to get that by trying to get to know people and perhaps get introduced to someone that you think could be a mentor or a sponsor by a peer.
We're talking to Joanne Lutlin, who is in Rochester tonight. She's a management news editor for The Wall Street Journal and the author of the book Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. Tonight, 7 o'clock, she'll be speaking in the Hawkins Carlson Room of Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. It's free and open to the public, and there's reserved parking available in the library lot if you want to attend. That's 7 o'clock tonight. We're going to be working through more of the details in the book and some of the themes of the book. I want to just stay on this one just for a second here. So let's say, you know, you're a woman making 50. You think you probably should make 60 based on a number of factors. So building sponsorships or mentorships can help you. What else? What else can we do to close that gap?
You could go get another job offer. I've written columns about this, and I quote some of the women in the book on this very topic, which is that when men step up to the plate and try and get a pay raise, if they don't get what they're looking for or close to what they're looking for, they make sure that they've already looked for some other possibilities, and if need be, they leave. And frankly, I've seen this happen in my experience at the Wall Street Journal. The people who get the biggest pay raises are those who have another offer out there pending, which they may or may not plan to take. I don't know, you know, how their mind works.
Got to be careful with that, though, right?
You do. And I have also written columns about that, which is, you know, to the extent you use another job offer as leverage to get a counter offer, you may have written your own exit package there because your current employer will say, God bless, good luck. But that may also then result in a much bigger pay deal. And so you should not go out and shop for offers simply as a bargaining tool to increase your pay where you are. It, frankly, is a way to make more money somewhere else.
You touch on gender stereotypes in a number of places and a number of chapters. And some women readers of your book might wonder if they want to reverse our conversation and say, wait, you don't get it if you don't ask. But women in particular get penalized just for asking. They're viewed as over-aggressive, overly ambitious. Men don't get called those things. Do you disagree with that?
No, I totally agree. And I think that's a pretty powerful theme in the book. And there's some pretty recent research that suggests that's still the case. And these are stereotypes that are held by women and men alike about women's leadership style. It all goes back to this thing called unconscious bias, which is the way we sort of navigate the environment, but also is going to give us a picture of how we expect people to act. And that's why a number of companies are offering unconscious bias training. Although there's a new article out very recently, a cover story in Atlantic Monthly, that suggests in some workplaces, after they offer this training, people actually become more prejudiced because now they become aware of their unconscious bias. Whoa. And somehow it's okay then to be biased. I'm not sure I get the connection, but I'm sure that the studies would support that.
Wow. Well, in one chapter on the subject of gender stereotypes, you kind of wade through how women might be treated differently, and sharing the story of a young woman at the time who was asked to wear a tie on a hot September day, mm-hmm. you know, because all the other men on the line were wearing ties. They had to. And so they were kind of complaining that, wait a second, she doesn't have to wear a tie. And so supervisor says, you know, well, we think maybe you ought to wear a tie. She responds by asking, do the men have to wear bras? And that was enough to convince her supervisor, okay, she's probably right. But then you draw the broad conclusion at the end of the chapter, use humor rather than anger to deflect gender stereotypes, gaining respect from male peers by connecting with them as one human being to another. But is that too broad? I mean, in other words, gender stereotyping does happen all the time. And I wonder sometimes, doesn't it merit anger or something besides humor?
Of course, it's going to merit anger sometimes, you know, especially if it's really awful. But I think and obviously in her case, humor worked. But in other cases, really trying to find some way to connect to a male colleague who is somehow pigeonholing you due to your gender or any other trait is really what the point is. And in her case, since the men bonded with each other over humor, she bonded with the men over humor. There's another great story involving Mary Barra, who's now the CEO of General Motors, one of a number of women I interviewed who have been public company CEOs. Early in her career, she's walking through a plant that she's assigned to at GM, and she gets wolf whistled a lot by multiple male line workers. And one guy in particular is doing this more than others. And she goes up to him one day and says, "What are you trying to do here?" I mean, she basically confronts him in a very low-key, not angry tone of voice, but out of curiosity. He said, "Well, I'm trying to communicate." And she said, "Great, let's communicate. I'm Mary Barra," puts out her hand, introduces herself. You know, she's not a senior executive at this point. She's a first-line manager, but he's an hourly worker. And they basically become peers and colleagues. And after that, she would always talk to him when she came into the plant. And guess what? All the other wolf whistles disappeared.
Certainly effective there.
I mean, it became the basis for her leadership style, which is empathy, okay? To walk in the shoes of the people who you work with and who work for you.
It makes me a little sad, though, sometimes that, number one, that women would be whistled at work like that, whoever they are, in any setting. But, you know,
they never whistled you at you here?
No, I don't know. But, but, you know, just as an example, that my mind goes to what you wrote later in the book, page 223. You wrote, women should not behave in an overly emotional manner because everything you do gets magnified and affects others' initial impressions of you. So I think of the whistling and had she responded in an emotional way. But then my response is, isn't she entitled to respond, to turn around and say, are you kidding me? As opposed to, look, I can't deny that the way she diffused the situation was powerful. But I feel like, you know, it's 2017. Shouldn't we be turning this around saying, okay, sometimes people react emotionally, men and women, maybe sometimes women more than men, maybe not. But are we going to penalize the women, or are we going to penalize the people who penalize them for being emotional?
No, I think you make a good point. In fact, I was in one dialogue about the book in which somebody said, you know, is it ever okay for women to cry on the job? And my answer was, yes, if the men in the room are crying at the same time.
Oh, come on.
No, because
that's unfair,
otherwise
isn't
you're
it?
Feeding the stereotypes. If the women start crying in the middle of a meeting.
But isn't that unfair to women?
Of course it's unfair, but whoever said life was fair?
Oh.
It's 2017 and women are still penalized for being overly emotional.
I know, and I feel like I'm the one who's sitting there saying, wait a second, we got to talk to the executive to say that it's not okay to penalize women for occasionally being emotional.
But again, it goes back
to
this unconscious bias.
I'm a crier.
It goes back to unconscious bias.
Okay.
And there's this great story in the book in which Ann Stevens is trying to, you know, prop up the shattered ego of one of the male executives on her team at Ford, who she's just chewed out because he missed a deadline. And he comes into her office and he's sobbing. I was like, give me a break. A man was crying in an office at Ford. She said, honest to God, he was crying. And I tried
Joanne, to... Joanne, men can cry. We don't just watch sports. We can do that.
I know, but how many times in your work life have you ever seen a man cry at work versus a woman cry at work? Count it up.
Not very many on either.
Okay. But probably more women than men.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying is pragmatically, you're just looking at the world
exactly.
in pragmatic terms.
There's this one executive in the book who they nicknamed the ladies' room the crying room because she goes there to cry so often. But it doesn't really hide her emotions because all the women come into the ladies' room and give her tissues.
I know. And we shouldn't penalize her. We should whack the men for calling it the crying room, right? The idealist
here. I don't remember who came up with
that. I'm the ideal. I know. I'm being an idealist here. But you're being a pragmatist.
But I'm an idealist too, and hopefully we're going to move to a society because as parents we're raising children hopefully to have different attitudes, but they are still subject to the social pressures and stereotypes of the world that they live in.
How much do you think it's changed since you got into the working world?
I think we've made huge strides in terms of the advancement of women. I think there are a lot of men now who care deeply about women being treated fairly, whether it's pay or advancement or hiring. And I devote most of the last two chapters of the book to the importance of men taking these roles, but there are not enough of them.
Not enough yet. Do you think by the time your kids, as you said, in their 30s, mm-hmm. are... you know, have kids in their 30s, that we'll be talking about a very different situation. You ended the book on an optimistic note.
Right.
Do you feel that way?
I think it's going to be a different world, just like it's a different world today than it was over 40 years ago when I entered the workforce. I just think that we have to be pragmatists as well as optimists about the fact that progress requires constant vigilance and action.
I have one more note on this theme, because there's been a little bit of debate about one of the points you make on page 78, and I suspect it's probably tiresome for Joanne, but I just kind of want to make sure we get clear on her feelings on it. You write there that women should, quote, avoid office parties with heavy drinking, late business dinners, or other potentially risky venues. Melanie Healy, the first woman to run the North American unit for Procter & Gamble, recommends thinking twice before you have a glass of wine alone with a male associate after work, end quote. Now, here's the idealist in me. Again, I go, it's 2017. Shouldn't women be able to say, hey, this is a colleague where if we have a drink or dinner after work, that's fine. Whereas this is a colleague where I probably would not do that, as opposed to broad brushing it saying, don't do it. What do you think?
Well, I think you have to choose your battles, but I also think you have to be mindful as to what's really going on here. And so I did an appearance a few days ago at the corporate headquarters of Toys R Us, and their executive vice president of communications relayed, you know, a very similar experience to some of the ones that Melanie Healy had gone through in her career. And this woman's a lot younger than Melanie. And in her case, she was in her 20s, met a high-ranking airline executive who said to her, I would love to hear more about your career. Here's my hotel room key. Meet me there after the dinner. And so you've got to be smart. And this kind of thing still goes on. There's another example in the book where a CEO who had been harassed, again, early in her career, gets approached by a 20-something, you know, staffer in her current company just 2 or 3 years ago who's being hassled by a customer. He keeps asking her to go out with him and doesn't take no for an answer. He's being rather overly aggressive about this and not subtle. And she's afraid that they're going to lose a customer, which for a startup company is pretty important. And she's already gone to her boss. And so she and her boss come to talk to the female CEO. What do you do?
And what's the answer to that?
Well, in this case, the CEO said to this woman, you know, we will stick by you, but let's see if we could figure out, you know, a solution without having to sort of go too far down this pike. And so she says to the young woman, are you involved yourself in a romantic relationship with someone other than this customer who keeps pestering you? And she said, yes, I am. And she said, let's try that. You know, go back to him and say, I cannot date you. I'm romantically involved. And if that doesn't work, then I am personally going to have a heart-to-heart chat with this guy. And I don't care if we lose the account. Okay. And the CEO then was willing to sacrifice a business relationship to protect this 20-something year old.
Do you think young women are naive about that?
I think we're all naive to a certain degree when we're young, weren't you? I was.
Well, I still am, probably, in some ways. I suppose probably. Let me grab a phone call. Pete in Canandaigua on the line first. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. This is a great discussion. And I'd just like to relay something that I learned a few years ago the hard way. I was on active duty in the Army. I was an infantry officer. And for the first half of my career, I honestly didn't work with any other women or any women at all. And then later in my career, I did start having more assignments working with women. And there was one time when I was a subordinate officer, a young female officer. She and I were having a discussion that turned rather heated, and she got emotionally upset and walked away from me. And I outranked her, and she was one of my subordinates, and I let that happen. And when we talked about it later, she apologized for walking away, and I said, no, it's me that should be doing the apologizing, because at that moment, I said, I treated you like a girl. I didn't treat you like a fellow officer in the United States Army. I didn't respect your position, your rank, and all of the hard work that it took for you to get where you got to. I treated you like a girl. And I learned really at that moment that, even in the military, it wasn't about gender. You know, it's about what that individual person is capable of doing. And it was a hard lesson that I learned at the time, but it's something that I've been able to carry on. And now since I've retired, I teach at one of the colleges here in the Rochester area, and it's a lesson that I share with my students about saying, listen, I respect you as a student first, not as a man, not as a woman, not as a Christian or a Jew or someone who's white or black or whatever. I respect you as a student first. Just like that day, I should have respected that young officer as an Army officer, not necessarily as a woman. And that this conversation, today has really, helped reinforce that idea. So I just want to say thanks.
Thank you, Pete. What do you think, Joanne?
I think those were very good observations, and I really respect the fact that they have stayed with you and you're still applying them in your current profession.
Joanne Lublin is the author of the book Earning It, and she is the management news editor for the Wall Street Journal. The book is Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. You can see her tonight. It's a free event in the Hawkins Carlson Room at the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester, 7 o'clock tonight. Again, free and open to the public. Reserve parking is available in the library lot. And let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back and ask her what she wants. Here's Pete telling us one thing he's already picked up from the conversation, what he hopes the people will say, what she hopes that people will say after reading Earning It. And we're going to talk about some other themes. In fact, we've got a couple of listener emails to get through as well. So much more with Joanne Lublin next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we welcome journalist Tiana Magnon from Open Mic Rochester. She recently did a piece on gentrification in Rochester, asking the question, is it always a good or a bad thing? When does it actually work for neighborhoods? We'll talk to her about that. Then in our second hour, author David Grinspoon. His book is Earth in Human Hands. It takes a 10,000-year perspective about our chances for survival. Talk to you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get a couple of listener points in here, starting with Martha in Canandaigua. She says, I have a question for Joanne about how to work better with female supervisors. My supervisor has verbally abused me, told me I need therapy, made comments about my sexuality, and told me she only hired me because of someone I knew. I don't see her as a mentor, even though she claims to be one. I remember a statement in Joanne's book about women pulling up the ladder to prevent other women from being successful. Why does Joanne think that women in powerful positions feel the need to compete with or essentially beat down the women that work for them? What can women in these lower level positions do to get past that?
That's a really good question, and I hear it a lot in going around the country talking about the book. I think at the end of the day, there are crappy bosses of both genders. There's quite a bit in the book about jerk bosses, mostly who are men, but certainly women, you know, men have no monopoly over being jerks. There are going to be jerk women bosses too. And if you find yourself in a situation in which you're jerky boss is a woman, I think you need to not only find yourself a different boss, and while you're doing that, you need to find other men and women who have stopped working for this woman and ask them for advice as to how they manage that situation until you can get yourself into a better place.
Now, is it concerning for Martha, who emailed, or whoever mm-hmm. it is, you know, to hear that you've got to find a different boss? That means find a different job. That might not be
not
something that's doable very quickly.
Not necessarily. You don't necessarily have to find a different job unless you're working in a workplace in which that is the only boss in the workplace. And then, yes, you will have to find another job. But, you know, in any workplace of any size, you know, there are other options. It may require you learning an additional skill. It may require you perhaps joining a task force that involves people from other departments so that you can get your reputation and your face known by people in other parts of the company so that you can help yourself to find a different boss within that workplace. But definitely, you should not, you know, life is way too short. You should not stick in a relationship like that where it's not beneficial for you.
All right, Emily emails, and I don't know exactly what legislation is referring to. Maybe a broad question. How does your guest feel about equal pay legislation?
Well, there is a variety of equal pay legislation out there. A number of states recently have passed laws that basically make it illegal for employers to ask about how much money you made in the prior job, and I'm not sure if that's what she's alluding to. I think that is a long overdue issue that is being tackled, thankfully, now in legislation. I wrote a career column on this topic a few years ago in which people were saying, you know, I can't even get an interview unless I disclose how much pay I made before. You can't leave that category blank when you're applying online. And yet, if I disclose how much pay I made before, they're not going to give me very much more to come work at this next company. What do I do?
And always the answer is, what do you do?
Well, at that time, there wasn't legislation. But now, like I said, we're seeing cities and states passing laws saying, because it is, as I pointed out before the break, a way in which the gender pay gap gets perpetuated.
I do wonder if we're going to see more of that Reddit kind of a model, that tech model that you mentioned, because it may make it simpler for companies anyway to say, look, we don't negotiate salaries. This is what this pays. And men and women make the same here. I mean, in some ways, you get good PR for that. You simplify the process. Do you think we're going to see more of that?
We might. It kind of depends on the push and the pull, you know, whether the companies think they need to be going down that road for whatever reason, or whether the job pool, the applicant pool, is demanding it. At the end of the day, you know, that is driving a lot of these decisions much more than highfalutin principles like equity.
Listeners, we got about 15 more minutes. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We'd love to hear from you about your experience in the workplace. Have you been treated fairly when it comes to money? Have you been able to find out what others make? Do you feel like in many ways women are treated fairly when it comes to salary, or how have you dealt with that? Any questions or ideas for Joanne Lublin, our guest, whose book is on these subjects and more? A lot of great positive reviews. So let's get one critical review for Joanne. So here we go. This is from Bethany and Sotis, and I wonder if millennials have a different feel on this. She identifies herself as a millennial. She says, Evan, thanks for the show. I'm a millennial looking to advance in my career, and I picked up a copy of Joanne's book, looking to learn some strategies on making my next move. And I have to say, I'm disappointed in how much emphasis the book places on relying on men to open doors for women, and how women need to make concessions like worry about wardrobe and avoid traveling with men because it could be perceived the wrong way. I'd like to think we're past that. I've been working in my industry for about a decade, and the emphasis for me has always been on collaboration. I can't imagine putting up these barriers while still being collaborative and productive. Is Joanne's advice generation specific? I don't think most millennials necessarily relate. That's Bethany.
Well, I think she raises a lot of good points, but I also think that the world is not all that different today than it has been in years past.
You don't think it's changed that much?
I think it has changed a lot, but not as much as millennials would hope. In fact, the Wall Street Journal commissioned a survey that we wrote about last September of 34,000 employees, and nearly one in four millennial women reported they have already experience setbacks in getting ahead in their careers due to their gender. And that percentage, that 23%, was only one or two or a couple percentage points different than was reported by women at any age. And so the point here is that there are no black and white answers to any of these problems. You've got to adapt the advice that's in this book to obviously your situation. And so, yes, I applaud the fact that she is trying to be collaborative in her workplace. But she also has to be mindful of the fact that she's still being judged differently because she's a woman.
What about the wardrobe question? Is that fair to keep focusing on that, or do we need to get over wardrobe eventually?
I think at the end of the day, we are still judged on how we are packaged. There's a great quote from Denise Morrison, who is the chief executive of Campbell's Soup and one of the 52 women I interviewed. And it's at the end of the chapter on executive presence, which talks about the fact when we go in a grocery store, do we buy the, you know, package that is all crumpled and dirty looking, or do we look for that cookie box that is shiny and new? And so she addressed her comments to men and women alike, that you, as much as you don't want to be judged on how you look, you are going to be at least initially judged on your packaging.
Yeah, I mean, I anchored commercial television news for a number of years, and the feedback that the female anchors get, it's incredible. The men do not get it. I mean, it is not the same almost at all. Now, if I wore a tank top on the set anchoring, I probably would get some emails.
If you opened your shirt to your belly button and had no underwear underneath, you probably would have gotten some comments.
Okay, not what I was thinking, but yes, exactly. So, but regardless, it takes something extreme for a man to get feedback
that
like
that.
That
is true.
For women, it doesn't. And shouldn't we be spending more energy saying, let's stop that, as opposed to saying, look, ladies, this is just part of life, because it shouldn't be that way, should it?
Of course. In an ideal world, we should not have to be focusing at all about wardrobe issues, particularly on any greater degree for women than for men.
And I agree, by the way. Looking professional, important. But beyond that, as a baseline, it is obsessive the way we talk about women's hair, what they wear. I mean, the stuff that I saw just blew me away. That made me realize how unequal that was.
Right.
And I would love to see that change. How are we going to change that?
I would love to see that change, but we also have to be practical. And so some of the advice in the executive presence chapter comes from these senior level women who are counseling millennial women about the fact that you need to look the part, act the part, and, you know, dress the part when appropriate. And so in one case, for instance, they had a dress down Friday practice. And so this woman comes in jogging pants and top. And then unbeknownst to her, she gets assigned to be working on the executive suite floor. And there's a corporate board of directors meeting that day. The CEO sends the woman home to change before the board members arrive, because this is her executive assistant who normally is working a floor below. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with appearing professionally, but I think you're absolutely right, as is your listener. There is way too much emphasis about how women are, you know, their hair looks or makeup or whatever. But some of that comes from the women themselves focusing on other women.
Well, and that takes me directly to my next question, because as we see the percentage of women in executive offices, and your book cites several numbers, none of which give me all that much confidence in a state of real equality now, but at least the number of Fortune 500 CEOs, women in general executive positions, is higher than it was
Absolutely.
A generation ago. It's not parity, but it's moving in a better direction, if more slowly than we like. I want to ask you, Joanne, if you sense that the more women we have in executive positions, are they setting a culture change where we will obsess less over these gender differences, gender stereotyping. In other words, will it be easier for women to rise in the ranks the more women who end up in executive positions?
Yes, and that's the thing that gives me the most hope and optimism about the future. It's the fact not that we have a handful of women as chief executives, is that we are starting to have a significant number of women in senior management who are a level or two below the CEO, who predominantly is a guy. And those women are not only changing the policies, much more importantly, they're changing the corporate culture and what's acceptable and what can be tolerated to a far greater degree than we've ever seen before.
Yeah, and something else I learned in your book, we're seeing more women in these positions, women on boards, for example, as opposed to just a token female. I forget the golden whatever.
The golden number is 3. At least.
You know, this notion that, well, we're just filling a quota and that's all we care about. It's less about that and more about actual substance these days.
Well, not only that, there have been a lot of studies that show that the more women you have on a corporate board and the more women you have in senior management, the better the financial performance of the company, which is why at the end of the day, this is an issue that men want to care about as much as women, because they want to see these companies be successful.
You've lit up the men as well here, by the way. John and Henrietta is next on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Yes. In the mid-90s, I was working for a high-tech company out in California, and in the HR department, training department specifically. And we had a woman come in, and I forget her name, unfortunately, a doctorate in psychology, who talked about the difference between male and women cultures historically, and male being hierarchical, and female being, she referred to it as flat. Co-equal, you know, the women, you know, historically supporting the babies, the cooking around the circle of the fire, etc. And she said the problem with this is that it will cause women to resent and even attack other women who begin to advance. Who does she think she is, you know, and either directly or indirectly. And I don't know if this is still a problem. You know, we've talked about the millennials having a different attitude, but did you deal with this at all in your book or in your work?
Well, this is what some people have called the queen bee syndrome, and there's been a ton written about this topic over the years. But there also been a number of studies, some of which Sheryl Sandberg, the author of Lean In and herself a senior executive, have recently written about and have pointed out that there are overwhelmingly many more studies that show the more women get into senior management, the better things are for women in lower and middle management. And so there's this myth that somehow there is still this pulling up the ladder behind them, that women do not want to see other women advance. And I think it's a greatly exaggerated and, frankly, for the most part, untrue phenomenon in terms of a trend or a practice.
All right, here's another millennial email from Julie. Julie says, I'm a female millennial in management at a home improvement store. I encourage all my employees to express their emotions, especially when women are crying. Emotions are humanity. Empathy accelerates camaraderie and teamwork. My generation of female peers is tired of being told to bend to appeal to men. We are the new generation of management, and we believe in empathy. We make the rules now. That's from Julie.
I say, hear, hear. Go for it, Julie. And in fact, empathy is one of the very important leadership traits that a number of these women I interviewed exhibited. And frankly, in having written a career column for the Wall Street Journal for many years, I've also written about its importance in male leaders. But I think often women have some better skills at practicing empathetic leadership. But to be a truly empathetic leader, you've got to be a really good listener. And you've got to know when to talk and when to just let people express their point of view and their feelings. And that may mean when you're leading a meeting to be the last person to express your point of view so that everyone can feel that what they have to say is valued.
Is empathy looked at as weakness?
No, I think empathy is increasingly looked at as a very important and valued leadership trait by companies in hiring and promotion of women and men alike, from the reporting I've done on that topic.
What would you say about the preponderance or lack thereof of women of color in positions of leadership, executive positions? and a lack of general progress there, or maybe you see it a different way?
I think it's because it's unfortunately a situation of double jeopardy. As much as progress has been made in terms of women in the workplace, as well as people of color in the workplace, for a woman of color, you're still being judged against two different stereotypes. And I think it's very, very difficult. If your listeners have not seen it, I would highly recommend this movie, Hidden Figures, which frankly, you know, opened my eyes quite a bit to what women of color have to deal with.
Down to our last couple of minutes, and I asked Joanne Lublin, who is the author of Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World, what you want your readers to get out of the book. And maybe you're hearing from a lot of them already. But what do you want people to take away from this, Joanne?
Well, what I want people to take away from this book is a great sense of, wow, you know, these women who have gotten to these high-level jobs are frankly pretty down-to-earth human beings who made mistakes, but who learned from these mistakes, who learned from having encountered obstacles, and who were able to somehow figure out ways to recover or find a route around the obstacle. And so I hope that people who read this book come away not only inspired, but optimistic about their own prospects.
Sometimes people think about their career and they imagine that it must be a straight line steadily upward. And at one point in the book, you talk about a zigzag.
Right.
And I thought that was inspiring and reassuring for anybody in any position, whether you end up in management or not. Because again,
right,
most of us are not going to end up like the executives that Joanne interviewed.
No.
And may not relate to that kind of a lifestyle, but a zigzag is sort of a normal thing. And maybe let's close with that thought, that that's okay, that certain decisions you make, sometimes a step back, sometimes a step down in pay, doesn't mean the end of a progress upward.
No, and if anything, I think a zigzag career is a much more interesting one, because who knows what new venues, what new territories, what new skills, what new technology you're going to learn about when you take that lateral move, or even perhaps take a pay cut because you've moved into a new industry and nobody believes you can do it.
We're going to see your work. Where else do we see your work, Joanne?
Well, I write for the Wall Street Journal, and I've been on a lot of radio and television appearances, and there's an item that just got posted this afternoon by Business Insider, in which it talks about the issues of two career couples.
Which, by the way, could have been its own subject for a different day, perhaps, for
perhaps
you. Joanne Lublin is management news editor for the Wall Street Journal. Her book is Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World, and you can see her tonight. If you heard the program or you think someone would be a good fit for this, tonight, 7 o'clock in the Hawkins Carlson's room at the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester, free and open to the public. Safe travels. Thanks for being here. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Joanne Lublin. Our thanks to Kat Schwarz. Look at the all-female team behind the glass. Kat Schwarz is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon. And we'll catch up with you on Thursday on member-supported public radio.